Welcome to The Kingstonian, a podcast that profiles individuals who are passionate about what they do for a living, about what organization they belong to, or simply passionate about the community they are a part of. Hello there and welcome. My name is Dave Cunningham. Over the past year, musicians have been anxious to perform. Not that easy during this pandemic. The Kingston Symphony is no exception. With our musical director Evan Mitchell at the helm, and with the help of some incredibly talented digital technicians, the orchestra has created some very interesting videos. You can view them at kingstonsymphony.ca. But that's only part of the story. I sat down with Evan to talk about his passion that all started with his first drum kit. Evan, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You have come to Kingston in September of 2014, is that correct?
That was when I first started as music director, that's right.
Okay. Before that particular point, you traveled some to get here. Let's go back a bit and talk about your passion for whether we call it classical or orchestral or romantic music. What's your passion? What do you really like about this kind of music?
I feel like great art is timeless, and it speaks to the moment, and it speaks outside of the moment. It's interesting you should ask that. I just had this conversation with my wife today about how, you know, you can take a look at certain things that were be it popular art or be it composed music. You take a look at 20 years ago versus today, and sort of the shifts in the way that we think and the way that we act, and just sort of what is expected of us as a society. That's all reflected in a snapshot of the music at the time. But timeless art, you can imprint upon it what you need it to be in that moment. It helps you be introspective, in my opinion. And it's sort of, because it's not tied to a particular period, you can have it be something that exists out of time and can just, you take all the positivity out of it. And I think that's why there are works, timeless works, be it in visual art, be it in music, be it in theater, Shakespeare, that have survived for so long and seem to exist outside the boundaries of time. And particularly as I get older, I get more enamored by that particular concept of just something that I was able to love as a child that I can continue to love now, mm-hmm. with, you know, decades more experience and society having changed, that you can look back on it and not be disappointed or not be, often we can be blinded by nostalgia. You know, there's something, you know, when you're younger, you experience something, you're like, wow, that was amazing. And then you go back to it 20 years later and you think, wow, that was objectively terrible. I just really enjoyed that as a kid.
Yeah.
And, the great music, great art, never lets you down in that regard. And so that true sense of friendship can live throughout your whole life.
What instrument did you start off with?
I actually started off as a drum set player, believe it or not. My particular path is a weird one. My first private lesson was when I was 16 years old. And I know a lot of my string colleagues, whenever I tell them that, they think, oh man, I can't believe you weren't a lost cause. Because as a serious orchestra musician, generally speaking, you do have a tendency to need to start younger when your brain is a bit more, when you've got a bit more neuroplasticity up in the old noggin. I started as a drum set player. I was really into contemporary Canadian rock and roll, actually, of the 90s. And when it came time for me to go to university, I was thinking I could either go to, say, a college program, say Humber, and have a college diploma in their jazz program. And that would have been great. I was very interested in jazz. But I was thinking that I wanted to become a teacher. And so for that, I needed a university degree. And that meant studying classical music, orchestral music, art music, whatever you want to call it. And it was a music that I had already loved. I just hadn't thought of all that seriously. But when I turned to it and it became my focus, it was like the world opened up to me. Mm-hmm. And eventually I sort of turned away from teaching and I turned away from percussion a little bit. I had done a lot of performance, but conducting was something I picked up during my undergrad and it became my focus. And that sort of brought me to where I am here today.
What is it about conducting? You know, there are a lot of folks who play in orchestral music and they play various instruments and that's their life's work. That's what they enjoy doing. What tends to get someone to gravitate towards conducting?
I would say a rampaging, out of control ego. That's the number one thing that you need. That's a facetious answer. You do need to have a certain sense of confidence because you have one person telling dozens of people. It's even harder when you're young because the dozens of people have infinitely more experience with a particular piece in front of you than you do. But you have to have that confidence and that preparation and that knowledge to be able to say, this is how I see this piece coming to be. And so this is my vision of the piece. I'm directing it as such. And I have to convince you all to sort of follow along. But I think people who love the music and who feel like they have something that they want to say about it are the ones who gravitate towards conducting. Because then when you're a player, you contribute an incredibly important, specialized fraction of that piece. You're a cog in the machine. You're an incredibly important cog as a violinist, as a violist, as an oboist, as a percussionist, as a clarinetist, trumpet player, whatever. But you have a very narrow, very focused, specialized piece of the puzzle that fits into the greater art. And as a conductor, you actually give up that aspect of making the sound. You don't make the sound, but you direct the sound. You inspire the sound. You lead the sound. And so for those who may be more big picture people or who may have strong opinions on the way that they feel the piece should go, those are the ones who it sort of appeals to. And then you try it out and it's a very strange thing. I mean, people ask, so what's it like to just sort of stand in a box and wave your arms around and have music happen? It really is. If you know, we don't think about it much in the moment, but it is a very strange thing. But it's a wonderful thing, and it's something that I adore. It's absolutely a calling for me. I've never felt as though I've worked a day in my life since becoming a conductor. It's a great thing to be able to come together. And I know how this sounds in the midst of COVID, but to come together with your colleagues who are all incredibly talented people. And to, as one collective, make great art. It's an amazing thing.
How long after you left university did you get to be a professional conductor?
When I left university, I finished my master's degree in 2005. And I went two solid years without having a single conducting job. Not one. I was a very successful freelance percussionist during that time. I was able to make a reasonable living during those 2 years after my master's degree, playing percussion with various orchestras, with various chamber ensembles, these sorts of things as a freelance player. But it was frustrating because, as I said, I'd had to make the choice for my master's degree to either pursue percussion or conducting. I couldn't really focus on both. It's very difficult to be proficient, particularly when you are doing your advanced studies, to keep a level of proficiency of more than one thing. And there are obvious exceptions to that. I am no genius. I am no musical uber talent. I needed to focus on one thing. And so I had turned to conducting. And then the irony was, as soon as I was done and I had my degree, which to date had been my highest accomplishment as a conductor, it was, can you come in and play percussion for this? Can you come in and play percussion for that? And don't get me wrong, I was delighted to. It's really a wonderful thing, particularly when you're getting out of school, to be able to have a professional career, to feel as though you've spent all this time and you've dedicated your life and all this energy and all this passion to be able to make a living doing something artistic that you've studied. It's an incredible experience. But it was like, well, okay, you know, have I made the wrong decision? Have I chosen poorly? And do I need to like start getting my snare drum chops back up and go on the audition circuit and try and get a full-time gig with a symphony? That'll take sort of a lot of work for me to get everything polished up to snuff. And then I had my first live audition with the Vancouver Symphony Orchestra in 2007 for their assistant conductorship. And I ended up winning that. And that was actually the first time I'd ever conducted a professional ensemble, a professional orchestra. And that actually helped me out a bit, I think, because I had no supposition that I would get anywhere in that audition. So I just went in and had as much fun as I could. And that relieved a great burden off of my back, the pressure of feeling, I need this job. It's time for me to get this job. I need to fight for this job. I was just like, oh, look at all these string players. There are thousands of them, it seems. And so, yeah, that's sort of how how it came to be after that. I spent 2 years doing percussion, and then I had this Vancouver job, and it was the beginning of my conducting career, and I've never looked back.
Now, in Vancouver, it was around the same time that you started to get involved with the Olympics.
That's right. So my position as assistant conductor of the Vancouver Symphony Orchestra was through the 2007 season through the 2010 season. So three years. And it was really great timing for me, because during that time, they did a Beethoven festival, they did a Brahms festival. So it was like an intravenous injection of the standard repertoire, boom, boom, boom. We did a couple of tours, an historic tour to Asia, actually, which was really remarkable. Took part in the Beijing International Arts Festival. And then on the tail end of it was the Olympics. And it was a really spectacular time to be in Vancouver.
After Vancouver, where did you end up?
So after Vancouver, my Vancouver position was finished. I freelance conducted for a year. And then I won a position with the Kitchener-Waterloo Symphony Orchestra as its assistant conductor. And that was really a wonderful thing, because Kitchener is, I was born in Kitchener. I lived in Waterloo for most of my life, up to the point where I moved out west to British Columbia. And that was the first orchestra I ever heard. In fact, my earliest orchestral memory is hearing the Kitchener-Waterloo Symphony Orchestra play Peter and the Wolf. And I was there on a school trip. And so to then do that myself as assistant conductor, to perform Peter and the Wolf for a bunch of young students, it was something I'm very proud of, and a really wonderful experience. So I did that. I was the assistant conductor of the Kitchener-Waterloo Symphony Orchestra at home for 3 years. And that dovetailed into my position with the Kingston Symphony as music director, where the audition process came up in my last year as assistant conductor with the Kitchener-Waterloo Symphony. These positions are usually about 3 years. They rotate, and then, you know, they sort of they you leave and someone else comes in to sort of have the residency. And so it was actually really wonderful timing, and I was absolutely delighted to have won that position. And that's pretty much where I've been since, of course, as a music director of the Kingston Symphony and guest conductor of other orchestras.
Let's talk a little bit about music. We've got a selection that you gave us that you wanted us to play. And we're going to do something a little different than we normally do on this program. We're going to play a little tidbit of the tune and then come back and talk about the piece of music and why you chose it. So let's play a little bit of this particular bit of music. Okay, I'm sure a lot of people recognize that little tidbit. Why don't you tell us why you chose it? And just in case someone did not recognize it, what is it from?
So this is the Raiders March from the Indiana Jones series, written by John Williams. And the reason why I picked this piece of music, and thank you for humoring me for altering the format a little bit, I get asked quite often, what is your favorite piece of music? And as a professional musician, it's a difficult question, because you can't really pin that down to one thing. The answer I hear from other conductors most often who get asked, what's your favorite piece of music? They'll say, whatever's in front of me at any given day, whatever's on the music stand. And that, to a degree, is absolutely true. The reason why I chose this piece of music for all of you to listen to is because I think it is actually a perfect piece of music. And it is my answer to people, even though it's not entirely true, simply because, again, there is no answer to, for me, what is my favorite piece of music. It's the answer that I give to people who ask, what is my favorite piece? And the reason why is because, first off, in not even the 5 minutes that it runs, but literally within 10 seconds, it accomplishes everything that it needs to do. For those who aren't able to actually recognize it from the opening bars before the trumpets come in, as soon as the trumpets come in with yum, da-dum-dum, 90% of people know what this piece is and what it represents. And it just has such incredible craft that it makes you feel as though you could do anything. The purpose of this music, to give that sense of endless adventure, you know, hey, Andy, let's hit the road one more time. Let's see what we have in front of us today. It's really incredible. You can listen to that music 10,000 times and still find it stirring. But beyond that, It's structurally perfect. The middle part of this march, which is something that that people often don't necessarily listen to or they're not acquainted with it, is actually Marion Ravenwood's theme. And to me, that's one of the greatest character themes that John Williams ever wrote. And that's a big compliment because, of course, he's had decades of extraordinary musical themes. But it's so beautiful. It's so haunting. It really exemplifies Marion as a foil to Indiana Jones. And it even grabs parts of Indiana Jones's theme and twists them a little bit around in her own theme to sort of show their partnership. And the way that it sort of it courses from Indy's march into the SEG, into Marion's theme, and then how it just, again, goes back into the reprise of the Indiana Jones theme. It's perfect. You couldn't do anything to that to make it any better. Anything that you would do to it, be to put something in to take something out, would just make it worse. As functional music goes, you're never going to do any better.
Raiders March, John Williams and the orchestra, and that is from the movie and the choice of our guest today, whose name is Evan Mitchell. John Williams, I mean, we talked a little bit about him before we started, but he's what, in his mid-80s, if not older?
I think he's actually, I think he's closer to his mid to late 80s. I think I want to say that he's 87.
Mm-hmm. Something like that. I don't know if you heard the story of Steven Spielberg coming to John Williams when he was looking for music for Schindler's List.
Yes, this is the one where he said, "I'm not a good enough composer to be able to do this." And then Spielberg's answer was, "I know, but they're all dead."
That's right, exactly. Yeah. And that says a lot about John Williams, who continues to put out good music. I've spoken with a lot of other musicians, more of the pop variety, who are, you know, trying to make their way or plow their way through this pandemic and figure out what to do, whether it be recordings at home or doing concerts online or that sort of thing. From your perspective, what are you doing in this particular period of time when we can't see big orchestral concerts coming to the Isabel Bader Center, which we should talk about as well?
Oh, absolutely. Well, so the worst thing about this pandemic from a musician's perspective is that both as an audience member and as a performer, music of this type requires proximity. And with social distancing, we have been robbed of proximity. And it's not just a matter of it being functional. It just feels very strange to be doing. If you imagine an orchestra of, let's say, 75 people, they're all playing together within more or less, let's say, a tenth of a second. That level of precision, it's remarkable. And it's the sort of thing that we sort of take for granted as players after having done it for some time. But it really is a miraculous sort of thing. And to be able to do that, we're all making music together. It's a collegial process. It's just great to be able to be close, to be able to like see someone, not just out of your periphery, but full on in front of you, to be able to catch up on the subtle nuance of the physicality of your neighboring performer and be inspired by that, or to catch a leadership cue from that. It's integral. It's fundamental. It's foundational. I think the pandemic caught a lot of us a little bit flat-footed. We at the Kingston Symphony Orchestra have been in a really excellent position because we have, first off, the Isabel Bader Center and the amazing technical staff that are there. Early on, the Isabel staff did some really remarkable things as initial projects during the pandemic to sort of spread their digital wings a little bit further. The first of which was they sort of happened in tandem. The first of which I'm remembering is the online summer festival they had with a lot of live stream concerts, which they did brilliantly. And the second, which is one of the greatest technical achievements I've ever encountered during the pandemic, and that was the online cello competition, in which instead of having all the finalists of this cello competition come in and play on the Isabel stage, they all played in real time remotely from their separate locations, which spanned as far away as I think somewhere in Germany. And the greatest challenge with that is you're ceding a lot of control, a lot of technical control, to someone who is not as experienced or knowledgeable as your technical staff. And also, they're so far away that there's not much you can do if something goes wrong. So that was incredible. So I will sing the praises of the Isabel Bader Center and their vision and their technical staff the whole way, you know, till the day I die, because that was remarkable what they did. And we have certainly taken full advantage of partnerships with our own streams that we have done during the pandemic. The other thing that we have is that we have a music director, and that is me, who had some experience prior to this with digital video editing and sound editing. And once we realized we were in this for the long haul, which was almost instantly, actually, lockdown happened, I think, March 13th or the 14th, maybe. It happened in British Columbia on the 13th. I was, Alberta. I was in Calgary on March 13th, and I was doing a show with the Calgary Philharmonic. It would have been a series of three shows, choir on stage, dozens of musicians on stage, and it was going to be absolutely fantastic. And between the dress rehearsal and the show, which was a 90-minute stretch of time, their head provincial officer of health said, no more public gatherings. And so instead of doing the performance, we were tearing down the stage. And then I was stuck in the hotel for the next day because there was a snowstorm and the airport was closed. And so I just had this 24 hours where I saw a year's worth of work disappear as everyone preemptively started to shut things down, which is, of course, the right choice. But on top of that, I had all sorts of discussions with Andrea Houghton, the orchestra, the Kingston Symphony's general manager, about what we were going to do. And so between the experience that I had with digital video editing and audio editing, and my experience with these live in concert productions, we've put together a rather robust series of digital initiatives that I honestly, and I'm not trying to toot my own horn, I'm tooting our collective horn here. I really think that they are pioneering and that we can consider ourselves at the Kingston Symphony leaders in this field. Because since the pandemic started, we did a standard isolated performance of the finale of Beethoven's Third Symphony, the Eroica, which I think to date remains the most complex and the longest uninterrupted digital performance of isolated musicians to date. We've had our Harmon in Space series, which I don't know if you've seen. This is a series for young people involving our brilliant partners at Gazelle Automations, who are puppeteers and visual effects artists. We're very proud of that series. We've had two full orchestral premieres of new works that we have commissioned during the COVID pandemic, which have had tens of thousands of views, one of which was with John Astacio, his Domestic Divertimento, which involved an awful lot of fun household items, wine glasses, blenders, toasters, slamming of dishwasher doors, etc. And Dean Bury's Nijmegen Bridge 1944, which was something we were going to premiere live. We obviously couldn't because of the pandemic, but it was we premiered that for Remembrance Day. It was part of his great project, Tracing Colville, four orchestral movements on four war paintings of Alexander Colville, the celebrated Canadian war artist. And that represented a collaboration with Sinfonia Rotterdam. And we were able to literally have an overseas trumpet call to start that. To start that video. And so we've done an awful lot to answer your question. Sorry that you asked about 10 minutes ago. What have you been doing? We've been working very hard at maintaining our relationships with our local audience and with the digital audience through our smaller sized live concerts that we've streamed at the Isabel and through these digital initiatives, of which I think are really industry leading. And so we're in a great spot. I can't believe I'm saying that, but it's true.
I would imagine a lot of these initiatives that you have brought into place during the pandemic will show up somewhere down the road after the pandemic is gone and you're back to doing things as you used to.
Well, that's the hope. We actually, we had an unveiling of a new logo and a new branding, which finished right as the pandemic was starting. And so in some aspects, it was the best of times. It was the worst of times. The worst of times, obviously, because we couldn't have a proper rollout of it, but the best of times because it meant that we could associate this new logo with a new fresh thinking in the face of all of this craziness. One of the things that we were inspired to do in fact, directed to do during this pandemic was to try and see if there was a way. In the early days, everyone was just scrambling to do something. Let's do something to stay relevant, to stay in the hearts and minds of our audience members. That's never a bad thing. Never, literally never. Yep. But if you can do that while also telling your story, then there's a vector, there is momentum, there is direction, and you are setting yourself up for when we exit from this. And absolutely, like there's going to be a lot of things that people do during the pandemic that we never do again as a result. That said, if we take a look, for example, at the digital premieres, if we're premiering a brand new orchestra piece, then all the musicians get their parts on paper, they practice it themselves, their individual parts. We come together, we rehearse as an orchestra and learn the piece to the point where we're comfortable with performing it, and then we premiere it to an audience. So the audience is experiencing that for the first time, but we've experienced it as a group for several days. With a digital premiere in isolation, the orchestra got to experience the premiere of the piece when the audience did. And there is no other scenario in which that would actually ever happen otherwise. So it's finding those sorts of moments that things like that are absolutely worth continuing. And on the checklist of things that we wanted to do, we want stay relevant, tell our story, and present content and videos and initiatives, which are the sort of thing that we can be proud of and we can continue after the pandemic is over. When the pandemic is over, we still want to continue with Harmon in Space. There's no question. I think that it does present an opportunity for everyone to be able to be to a degree unshackled from conventional thinking. And that can be a good thing when you're sort of shaken up that way. I mean, in our industry, ticket sales represent industry-wide roughly 33% of the budget. So that's to say, if you make your sales goals, if you sell as many tickets as you're expecting to, as you budget for concert X, you've covered one third of the cost to put that concert on, which is sort of a sobering statistic. It's way worse than opera because opera is, you know, just so expensive. For symphony, 30 to 35%, we sit around 32, 33. So that means the rest of it is made up with government funding, with personal donations, private donations, corporate donations, fundraising, volunteerism, the works. So, but you still have to think about, you know, if people don't buy tickets, you're in trouble. With COVID, we realized that the revenue model that we were going to have was one where it was unlikely that we would have very much ticket sale revenue at all. Best case scenario, it was so small that it was, for all intents and purposes, not an impact on the bottom line. Now, what that means is you don't need to consider that when you're putting together the season. Now, you do because you still want people to watch, but it meant that you didn't feel... For years and years and years, I wanted to perform a symphony by Vasily Kalinnikov, who is someone who no one had ever heard of. He wrote two symphonies. They're stupendous. I have a really wonderful, like an extraordinary programming committee in Kingston, and we have extraordinary audiences that are willing to go along with really freaky programs that are put together by us. Mm-hmm. We still wanted to find the right spot for the Kalinnikov Symphony. And so we paired it against the Rachmaninoff Vocalise, which we knew would be very popular, and Tchaikovsky's Variation on a Rococo Theme, played by Joe Johnson, one of the all-time great cello pieces. So there was enough there to hook people, and then the Kalinnikov people would say, well, okay, I'll listen to that, but I'm glad that I have this stuff that I know. I know the Vocalise, I know the Rococo, I'm going to be excited about that. Now, I'm actually convinced we probably could, it could have been weird stuff top to bottom because we've done that before. But all this to say, oh, by the way, the Kalinnikov was hugely well received. It's a stupendous piece and the orchestra played so brilliantly. But anyway, the point of this is when you don't need to worry about that at all and you can just do what you think is interesting and poignant, and again, that gives you momentum during the pandemic, you'll see all sorts of orchestras right now that are programming things that in a normal season they wouldn't. And I think that that's an excellent thing. And so that spirit, I'm hoping we can all collectively as an art form continue that once we're clear of this.
So this pandemic, if there's one good thing about it, it's got the juices flowing so that you can be a lot more creative potentially than you normally would be. I think we have come to the end of the program today, and I thank you, Evan, for joining us and sitting down and giving us a bit more background on just the kinds of things that you do and the kinds of music that we can all look forward to once the pandemic is behind us. So all the best to you going forward.
And to you. It's been my pleasure. Thank you so very much for having me on.
And once again, my thanks to Evan Mitchell, music director for the Kingston Symphony, for taking the time to chat with us. The conversation was recorded using Zoom in late December 2020. Comments and suggestions can be directed to our Facebook page called simply The Kingstonian Podcast. Theme music for the program is Stasis Oasis, written and performed by Kingston musician Tim Aylesworth. This podcast is produced through CFRC Radio at Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples. The CFRC Podcast Network is brought to you by the generous support of the Queen's University Faculty of Engineering and Applied Sciences. My name is Dave Cunningham. Join us next time for the Kingstonian Podcast. Thank you for listening.